Save big on landscaping projects at Menards. Transform your outdoor living space with easy, no-cut block projects. From fire pits and grill stations to planters and fountains, we offer hundreds of free project plans that are easy to build with no block cutting required. Check out our huge selection of concrete landscaping block at Menards. And view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
Celebrate America's 250th with Dish. For a limited time, get an extra $250 off when you sign up. Call 888-ADD-DISH or visit dish.com today and use code DISH250 to claim your $250 savings. That's 888-ADD-DISH. Offer ends August 12th. Terms apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'm going to read you one listener question because I'm still going through stuff, but this was one I thought was interesting, and it was from Stumpy on YouTube. Stumpy said, I always feel that Richard Dolan is holding something dark back. He's literally the greatest of all time in this field, but I get the sense at the core of whatever's going on here, it's dark. Not demonic dark, but that we may be dealing with something that is bad, very bad. I don't know if that's a question, but I'm curious what you and him feel about this. It's speculation, but a lot of evidence points to something that doesn't have our best interest in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually... kind of spot on. But I think the thing that I see that is dark is, yes, there's reason to think that A, there are multiple intelligences that are observing and interacting with us. There's reason to think that some of those intelligences are not malevolently disposed toward us. But there is reason to think if you really want to go down into the rumor mill, but sometimes you want to do that. There has been reason to think that maybe at least one group does not have our interests at heart. I think that's possibly true. But the group that I would be the most afraid of is literally ourselves.
Mm.
I think I'm more afraid of humanity than I am of any, visiting group at this point. I think the reason that I have a dark view, and I guess I do, I just have to own up to it, is that I don't really think that we human beings have anywhere near the agency that we think we have, that we have the ability to guide our society in any way that is other than by the force of our technological development. Like we are completely and utterly dependent on the technological society that we have created that gives us more power, gives us longer lifespan, gives us a lot of benefits that we love, right? But we are dependent upon it, and we have essentially divorced ourselves from the rest of the planet in a way that I consider to be very deeply unhealthy. And I just have a feeling we're really only going to be here for a short period of time, because people talk about climate change. What I never hear people talking about is the fact that we live in an interglacial period in an ice age. You know, we live in an ice age. Earth has been in an ice age now for a couple of million years. especially the last 1 million years, it's been punctuated by usually 80,000 years of like massive ice sheets, and then 15,000 years at a time of, oh, wow, nice warm weather, which we are in right now. And if you look at the chart, it's extremely consistent. And you would see us at the high point where we have reached this high point a number of other times in the last million years. And where some people are saying it's global warming isn't going to keep going up, I keep seeing we're at the end. We're about 12 to 15,000 years in, and we're primed to have another ice age. But whatever happens, if you know what I guess I would say is Earth's climate is not stable, has never really been stable. We have been in a remarkably, unusually stable climactic period of Earth's history these last 12,000 years. Since the end of the Younger Dryas. So we're just on borrowed time, man. We're on borrowed time. So what would Europe do? Or what would North America do if the ice sheets came back? And by the way, all evidence shows that when they come back fast. So maybe within a couple of generations or a century. I'll tell you what would happen. The human civilization would not have time to adjust. And it would cause massive like warfare, dislocation of people. Like, we wouldn't be prepared for it. So we're on a very thin little skin of a planet, of a rock. There's a little bit of life, has a lot of life, but is in a tenuous and historically unstable position. So I just think it doesn't give me a dark view. I think it just gives me a realistic view. I look at what we are as a species. And I mean, I marvel. We do amazing things. We have an incredible ability to engage in profound ideas and generosity. Like, there's a lot of good things about humanity. But I think pretty much we're like a special at one of my favorite grocery stores. Here today, gone tomorrow. You know. So I think that is life. So when Lou Elizondo is saying, you know, love your family, I think that's actually great advice. I think the one thing that we really should always remind ourselves is that this life is a gift, and it's a beautiful thing. And there's an old bumper sticker I remember, something like, the worst day of fishing is better than the best day at work. And you could say the worst day of living is still better than not being here at all, because we're lucky to be here. I still am sad over the loss of my friend and colleague, Nick Pope, who was a couple of years younger than me. And Nick's gone. You know, I like to think, because I do have a spiritual belief, I like to think that he's in a place that he's enjoying and is good, but he's not here. So he doesn't get to go outside and enjoy the breeze and look at the beautiful trees and listen to birds. Like, there's a lot to be grateful for. And I think what I hope to do for whatever time I've got here, because we always go sooner than we think, right? I want to be able to genuinely have gratitude for every day that I have, because they're worth having, you know? So I'm a little bit black-pilled, yes, but not in a way that, not in a way that makes me depressed and sad. And, I mean, most of the time I think I'm actually pretty upbeat, and I try to enjoy every day, because every day is worth enjoying. Every day brings something really cool. And honestly, you want to know what really keeps me going? I mean, I'm married to a great woman, and, we live in a great place here, but what keeps me going is my curiosity about the world. I have an genuinely insatiable curiosity about pretty much everything I can imagine, certainly about this subject we've been talking about, but a lot of other things too. And so as long as I have that, I'm happy. I can explore things and learn new things. I actually really get into that.
Yeah, no, that's a good, you've put it across well. And before we talk about your book, I do want to ask you, news in the last kind of day or so, Avi Loeb, Professor Avi Loeb has announced online that he said on X, "I was tasked by the White House, Arrow, the ODNI, the FBI, and the intelligence community," which, what a hell of a way to start a sentence straight away there, "to lead and assemble a team of scientists and experts for a new UAP Science Advisory Council. The council includes Professor Carol Cleland, Professor Richard Cloat, Dr. Omar Eldadi, Tim Gallaudet, Ross Howard, Dr. Devesh Nandal, Gary Nolan, Regina Sarmiento, Michael Shermer, Professor Peter Scafish, Matthew Jagadis, and Jennifer Valor. There's a few names in there that folks will be aware of. Obviously, your Jagadis, your Nolan, your Gallaudet, your Scafish. Michael Shermer, though, is one that a lot of folks have raised eyebrows at as someone who is not only a noted skeptic, but has been incredibly derisory about the topic and people involved within the topic. I think some noted barbs toward David Grush were published too. What's your thoughts on this? I've not even shared my thoughts yet on it, Richard, so I'll let you go first.
Yeah. On the one hand, you want skeptical voices. You always want skeptical voices on a study like that. If nothing else, look, you have to have alternate opinions on a body like that. And it wouldn't be probably politically viable, I'm going to guess, if it didn't have some kind of skeptical position on there. I think that's probably the reality. Someone like Shermer, I mean, Michael Shermer he's a very intelligent guy, but he, as anyone who follows him has known, when you become a publicly acknowledged person in your field, it's very difficult actually to change your opinion publicly on almost anything because you develop your own audience. And I say that for people who believe in UFOs like myself as much as anyone. You establish a kind of a public turf and then you become kind of committed to that. For my part, I have always tried, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, to break free of expectations that people have of me in my own beliefs. And I've gone through my own journey, my own road. Michael Shermer is more established as a skeptic. And I think, you know, he probably, I have a feeling and, well, I want to be careful what I say here. But I think a lot of skeptics privately are more open to this phenomenon than they may publicly say, because they have a public position that essentially requires them at this point in their lives to act and talk a certain way. But I don't know that they all believe this. I don't know about Shermer per se, but it wouldn't surprise me if you had a couple of beers with him off the record. He might. I'm not saying I know this for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me that he might have a different opinion. So I don't really know what I think about that. What I think is important for a team like that is that it be genuinely multidisciplinary. I suspect that it is. And I'm glad Gary Nolan is part of that. Gary Nolan, I think, is a good presence on this. His opinion is, I don't really care what political leaders have to say about disclosure. The only thing I care about is, can it be discussed in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, like this reality? And I think that's actually a very intelligent position for a scientist to take. So I think that's a good thing to have him on there. What do you think about Shermer's inclusion?
I 100% understand the having a skeptic on board. I agree with the sentiments that are probably skeptics who, outside of their finding their tribe and having their audience, which no doubt supports them financially, whether it's their ego, whether it's pounds or dollar signs that drives them, whatever it may be, that goes across even the UFO community as well. There are loads of folks who enjoy the ego and celebrity that comes with it and arguing a cause, and they would find something else. I think my broader concern is there a danger? And I do feel better about a Gary Nolan being on there. I've spoken to a lot of the folks involved there from a UAP perspective, UFO perspective, Peter Scafish, Matthew Jagadis just recently as well. is there an element, though, I'm worried about the control of the conversation and the control of those people, where, and like I say, with Avi's initial statement around the FBI, ODNI, Arrow is still one that a lot of people don't have trust in. The intelligence community, all of a sudden, have got
no one who has any knowledge has trust in Arrow. No one.
Yeah.
Go on. I'm sorry.
But you're right. And I understand people are saying with under Kozlowski, they are a bit different, and it's taken a long time for them to throw off the specter of Sean Kirkpatrick that's loomed large over that organization since its inception and still does. But just in general, it just seems like you've got all these figures involved in the UFO topic who are now under the umbrella much closer to the secrecy and the gatekeepers. And is that just another way of controlling? I'm not too sure. Especially somebody like Avi Loeb, who has always been quite outspoken about control and transparency, and how if Project Galileo was going to find something, they're not at the whims of the US government or, you know, politics. It just seems like you've got two worlds there kind of combining, and I'm not sure really how I feel about that. I'm more wary than anything at the minute.
Well, I agree with you basically in your attitude on this. I mean, the thing is, anytime you get an established academician involved in this, you really, I mean, that includes Avi Loeb, he's at Harvard. You really do have to wonder, because the academic world has really not produced much of value on this subject. I mean, really, it's you consider the, you know, amount of intellectual power that would exist in the academic world, and how meaningless and paltry the actual level of thinking has been coming from that world. It's really quite remarkable. So you're dealing with a very powerful part of the establishment. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. These are this is U.S. government establishment directive to look into a topic that has profound and powerful implications in, let's just list them, national security, society, technology, cosmology, our beliefs. It has profound implications in terms of constitutional legality. And so much more. So this is not a subject that we should ever expect the United States government to just say to a group, yes, go off and do your thing, and whatever conclusions you come to, that's just great. Seriously doubt that'll happen. So you're right. This is going to be a controlled operation to some extent. It could be to a very large extent. Like, how could one not expect the most powerful government in the world, running a global empire, having maintained UFO secrecy for 80 plus years, to just walk away from the table and say, yeah, go off and do your own little study? They're going to try to control that as much as they can, and to guide that information flow as much as they can, I have no doubt.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
And as part of this, Chris Sharp at Liberation Times, he's reported today, and literally this has kind of been as I was preparing for this interview and ready to record.
I really like Chris.
Yeah, saying the US government has actually established a new interagency body to coordinate UAP investigations, improve the collection and analysis of relevant data, and assist with the declassification of UAP-related information. So it's not just this one, it's almost like this is a science advisory aspect of it, and it's going to be a bigger organization. Now, for me, the ODNI released a statement to Liberation Times saying, to support the President's directive on UAP transparency, ODNI, alongside FBI, Department of War, established a UAP governance board to provide guidance, recommendations, and coordination at the interagency level, bringing together military, law enforcement, the intelligence community, and other civilian agencies. So it's going to be, the UAP governance board is going to be supported by several advisory groups with expertise outside of the US government, of which it looks like this one headed up by Avi Loeb is like the scientific aspect of it. So again, to me, it seems like an even bigger dome over the topic. And is it almost like Hungry, Hungry Hippos, where they're just smashing and siphoning off stuff into different groups and boards? Will this mean these people are less likely to speak and talk more publicly? I think, obviously, we don't know yet. It's all very new. But yeah, I'm just really wary of, if we are at a point, to go way back to what you said earlier, Richard, where there's a small group of insurgents, there is a kind of mini revolution inside, maybe some of the private contractors, maybe some of the government agencies, maybe some of the military. Small groups of folks are trying to get information out and they're finding massive pushback. So as part of it, we get a little bit of something with the war.gov site, with some of the UFO files dropping. This, to me, could go either way. Is this something positive? Or is this these gatekeepers and the folks fighting back going, do you know what? Yeah, you're right. Let's take a bit more control of this narrative. Let's create a board. We're in charge of this. Yeah. Bang.
It's really both. I mean, think of any revolutionary group. Are they all sweetness and light? The French Revolution, they certainly went into crazy town. The American Revolution, you could find a lot of criticisms about the founding fathers. You could just say, yeah, they started a revolution, so they could then take over and make money unimpeded by the crown in the UK, which was true. Not everyone's motives are for the absolute greater public good, and that includes the UAP insurgents that I talked about. I know the politics of many of those people, and I certainly do not agree with a lot of the things that they believe. I have a strong suspicion, unproven, that some people involved in that are probably trying to get patents on technology that could make them a lot of money. But for that, maybe some UAP transparency would be helpful. Just saying, just a possibility. Not everyone's motives are sweetness and light. Does that mean that they should be opposed or that they're evil? Well, it just means that they're human. It just means that they're human beings. I don't expect pristine motives from anybody, whether government or whether they're this group here. Everyone's always looking out for their own interest. And if that coincides with the demands of truth, then that's awesome, but it doesn't always do that. So I think, I'm reminded of the title of one of Nietzsche's books, Human, All Too Human. And I expect that this task force or this advisory board is what it sounds like. I don't really see a lot coming out of it. I don't see a lot coming out of it, but it sounds like it's got a very vague mandate, frankly. And what is it exactly going to be coordinating? Are they going to have anything to do with future releases for declassified documents? It's really not clear. If there's something viable that they can actually do, that could be a good thing. Most of those people in the group, I don't really know them.
Yeah,
I have suspicions about. I would have suspicions about a lot of them, I bet, though.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, time will tell in the next couple of days and weeks. I think folks like myself and yourself will be looking into this more as information comes out. And like I say, there's even just today more information coming out to say it looks more like a bigger organization with advisory groups coming off the side of it. So I'll dig more into the Chris Sharp articles and whatnot there too. I've actually never had Chris on the podcast before. So as much as we've spoken a couple of times back in the day, maybe time to speak to Chris. But listen, Richard, let's close out with USO's Volume 2. So, God, what has it been a year since Volume 1? Less than a year now, isn't it? It
was a little over 1 year. I published the first volume in, I think it was the end of February of 2025.
God.
And I wanted the second volume out a little earlier. I always want them out earlier than they come out. You know, they're always a little longer and slower. But this one did come out in just about a month ago, May, and I'm very pleased with it. You have your copy. I've got my copy. So yeah, there it is. I love that book. I have to say, I'm very happy with it. So it's about big fat 400 pages. It's got a lot of USO unidentified submersed or submersible submerged objects. That I collected. And for someone who is not familiar with the series, there'll be a third volume, and I think that'll be out in a year, and that'll conclude the trilogy. But I started on this path, I think about 4 years ago, just by research. I've always been interested in USOs. I mean, who could not be? It's inherently fascinating. And I looked into a couple of USO cases, I think around 2022, and I thought, this is really quite interesting. And I thought, where are these cases? They're scattered all over the place. They're scattered in all these different databases and books. And I thought, I would like to hunt them down and just see how many there are. And that turned into my research. And I, you know, there was a couple of databases that were useful. Some of those databases no longer exist. I was able to do a rip of one of them before it completely closed down. That was waterufo.net by the late Carl Feind. He was a very good researcher on this. Thank God I ripped his site, because it doesn't exist any longer. So, there's different sources like that, and a lot of out of print magazines. Out of print books, and I just collected. And what I started to realize, like, this is a massive subject that had hardly ever been treated in a serious way in book form. A couple of books over the years, not many at all. And so I wanted to, once I collected enough of the cases, I just wanted to do as complete a treatment of them as I could. And my main goal was, I just thought it was a horrible tragedy that these incredible cases have nearly all been forgotten. 99% of the cases that I have in here have just been totally unknown. One or two were known to researchers. So I thought they've just been lost. And when you visualize what these cases were, what these events were, and how incredible they had to be to the witnesses involved, I thought, you can't let them be lost. So I wanted to kind of give them a new life and write them out in a way that did justice to them, and did justice to the witnesses who were there and to the people who investigated them at the time. And I thought that these stories should not be lost. That was really my motivation. Once I completed all of that, my wife, who always has good advice, gave me a bit of advice on this one. She said, you know, it would be really nice if you had categories in front of every case, like a kind of a boil it down. Like, this is, what color was the craft? What did it do? Did it enter the water? Did it emerge from the water? What shape was it? And all of these factors. And I ended up going back over all of the cases, and I extracted those facts. And then from that, I created a large spreadsheet, which I'd never created a spreadsheet before, and this was a massive one. But I'm so glad I did that, because by seeing those cases laid out that way, I was able to see patterns, and I was able to engage in a kind of analysis. Like at the very beginning of this program, I said my biggest interest in this field is a kind of behavioral analysis of these craft. And this is the reason why, because I was able to study behavioral patterns in these USO craft that I would never have noticed had I not done that legwork. So just so many things. So in this particular volume, so the first volume covers a long period of time from the earliest, from what I consider the earliest legit USO cases up until the end of 1969. So that covers a long period of time. The second volume only covers two decades, the 1970s and the 1980s. That's it. And I think I wrote in the introduction, this period suffers the typical fate of the middle child, you know, because it's the middle volume in the series, and it's easy to get forgotten. But in a lot of ways, the 1970s in particular were an absolutely peak decade of activity for this phenomenon, a mind-blowingly peak activity. I mean, and this is all pre-internet, keep in mind. And still, the largest number of cases that I have been able to collect are from the 1970s. And actually, there is a peak that really went from the late 60s up until the early 80s, but really all of the 1970s. And not only that, so there's a quantity that was really quite shocking to me, but also behavioral changes. So one thing that happened, really it started at the end of the 60s, but by the 70s it was in full swing, and that was a shift of the phenomenon toward predominantly nighttime operations. So prior to the late 60s, of all the cases that I collected, it was almost exactly 50% were in the daytime and 50% were at nighttime. After that, during the 70s, it was 75% were at night. And that goes to almost 90% if you look at military encounters. Military encounters were nearly 90% at night after the late 60s, which is astonishing. So like I look at that and I think, okay, is my data sample large enough? Well, I can't really know for sure. It's large enough that I thought, you know, 700 cases is not completely trivial. And yet this pattern emerged. And I'm thinking, why did that emerge? Why did this go to night? I really wonder if that's the case with aerial cases as well. And I may want to go back and try to review that. There's so many more aerial cases to look into. But nevertheless, I think that something shifted by the early 70s to nighttime and nighttime operation. Another thing that shifted or increased was cases of electromagnetic interference by these craft, whether of military or civilian boats or, you know, craft, really to an extreme degree. So that a typical situation would be where an object approaches a vessel. Could be American, could be Soviet, didn't matter. It gets close enough and then all the systems go offline. Sometimes, and in some cases, one Soviet case I can think of, the engine, this is of a large warship, the engine died. The engine of the ship died while the object was nearby. Frequently communications go down. Frequently weapon systems go offline. So this phenomenon seemed to know exactly what it was doing, that the sometimes, you know, when you look at cases of electromagnetic interference, we tend to think of it as a kind of residual effect of the craft, not necessarily intentional. But in my study of this, I think that it's very, very much intentional, that the EM is a tool, perhaps you could even say a weapon, but definitely a tool used by them to disable us while they were engaged in observing us in the way that they wished. So they approach, they shut down our systems, and then when they're done, they're done. They just take off and they're gone. This happened so many times. So many times. I really think...
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right, every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
There's a lot of strong patterns. One of the strongest patterns in the book is this repeated interaction between USOs and military assets. This book is not all military. Most of the cases are still civilian, but aircraft carriers, destroyers, submarines, strategic naval facilities, like these appear again and again and again, not just American, but Soviet, primarily those two. To me, the pattern suggests much more than accidental encounters. Like these objects seem very interested in the very systems that represented the most advanced military capabilities of that era, especially nuclear-powered platforms and things like that. So I think there's a lot of reason to believe when you look at the behavior of these USOs that they are engaged in a very careful observation of human technological capabilities. That is what really looks to me. The strongest patterns are definitely behavioral in this. It's like observe, monitor, approach. Like it feels to me like they're testing reactions, occasionally interfering, and then they just leave. I didn't find a lot of evidence of overt hostility, but I didn't find any evidence or hardly any of friendly communication either. So instead, really, the behavior to me resembles, if I had to characterize it, a long-term surveillance and reconnaissance program. Like whatever they are, they don't seem to be interested in introducing themselves to us, but they do seem interested in studying us. So, that's that. And aside from some of the just astonishing cases that blew my mind, those are really the key things that I think I would have to say out of this new book of mine.
In a minute, I'm going to ask you just to give us a taste of one case. But just before that, something that struck me, and I think we spoke about this in the original interview for the previous book, was the changing technologies. And the 60s through the 70s into the 80s probably saw as big a jump in maritime technology as maybe any other decades. As somebody who's a complete layman, I'm just looking at the Cold War era, submarines from the United States, Soviet Russia, and others just grow generationally almost overnight with nuclear-powered submarines, with the missiles on board becoming more advanced, GPS comes into play, stealth technologies come into play. So all these different warships, and again, not the civilian side, but the military side, the water suddenly becomes a much more active place, a noisier place with all these signals and frequencies jumping about. Do you think that played a big part in the behavioral change of the phenomenon at the time?
I do. Yes, I do. I think you asked it very, very well. That's a really well way to put it. Good way to put it. Like if you think of where human civilization was in the year 1900, so 126 years ago, that was the year that we had the first operational submarine ever. So we go from there, first time we're going into the water. And of course, by today's standards, not a very effective submarine, but it was the first. And then shortly after that, we start developing sonar around the time of World War I. And then radio for out above water communication. And then World War II, you start seeing large battleships and aircraft carriers for the first time. And then in the 50s, nuclear submarines that could stay under the water for months and months at a time. So our capabilities just radically changed in just 50 years, 50 years. So if you're them, you had to be thinking at the beginning of this period, we have full run of the waters. What can they do? They hardly have the ability to go under the water. And suddenly now they do, these humans. So it would have to cause an adaptive aspect to behavior if there is an intelligence that was down there all this time, which I think there was. So they've had to adapt. And I think they have to continue to adapt. Because now, I mean, I think the shift to nighttime operations, for example, one researcher pointed out to me, he said, well, yeah, it was in late 1960s that I think it was the Keyhole satellite developed a very advanced optical capability, particularly during daytime, like of exceptional resolution and practicality, but not so much at night. And I thought, oh, well, that I don't know if that is the answer, but that could be an answer. Or that could be one answer as to why the phenomenon seemed to go to nighttime observation, nighttime operations a little more often. I'm just guessing here, but I think the adaptive behavior of the non-human intelligences behind this has to be something we need to pay attention to. We're not the only society that's changing. They have to, if they are going to be here without us interrupting them, it's very likely they've had to make changes in their behavior as well. And I think it's possible to see those changes if we look carefully.
And is there any particular case through the research, through the time doing it, that either had a bit of a holy shit moment for you or totally blew your mind or you just did not expect to see in what you were working on?
Yeah, several. Several. One was a case that was kind of fun to research. In my first volume, I had several cases dealing with the U.S. aircraft carrier, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Had a very active history. It was retired, I think, in the late 70s. And in the 1950s, had a bunch of UFO and USO encounters. Well, I got one from the FDR from 1975, not long before it was decommissioned. And it was a strange case. I first caught a reference to it in an old MUFON magazine, MUFON Journal, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And it was just a passing reference to this alleged case that happened with this aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean in 1975. And I tried to find the source of it. I found that the source of the case was an outdated magazine, which I got to show you. I have not put this one away. So look how old this is. This is like classic tabloid 1970s. This is a 1977 or 78 magazine. I think they only had like 3 or 4 issues. Ideals UFO magazine, issue number 2. So like, oh, so I had to pay like $40 for this thing to get it in the mail. And I'm like, I hope this doesn't totally suck. Well, I read the article and the article did not suck. In fact, the article, let me see if I can find it here, was exceedingly well written. And, oh crap, man, I'll find it here. Here it is, USOs. So look how just goofy this looks, right? It's classic. You could see this in magazine racks of stores, you know, the cheesy UFO magazines. But this is actually exceedingly well written by an F.B. Newman. So I looked up F.B. Newman, and I'm like, there's no one by that name. There's no UFO researcher who ever did anything else under that name. And in fact, I couldn't find any other F.B. Newman at all in the 20th century other than one guy who did some medical research. And so this clearly wasn't him. But I searched a little further and I discovered that F.B. Newman was the pseudonym used by a man who was a U.S. diplomat and a military historian. And I know that this was the guy. And I just want to, I'm going to find this in my, my book here. Here we go. Robert Doerr. So he has his own Wikipedia page. He wrote like 70 books on military aviation. He was an expert. And as a child, as a teenager, he used the pseudonym F.B. Newman when he had, as a kid, written to Boeing and a bunch of other aircraft companies asking for pictures of their most advanced aircraft. The FBI investigated him because they thought he might have been a spy. He just was a smart, geeky teenager who was into aviation. But they discovered that he used F.B. Newman as a pseudonym because some letters with that name came out of his house. And I thought, oh, well, so Robert Doerr, in this article that I was just showing you, it's all based out of Washington, D.C. information. Like he's talking to this guy in D.C. and that guy in D.C. Well, Robert Doerr lived his entire life in the Washington, D.C. area. And he would have been perfectly positioned as a diplomat to have connections who could have given him a story that happened on the FDR in 1975. So he writes this out. And what he wrote was the ship. And by the way, he accurately placed its position in May of 1975. Like, that would not have been easy to do for a writer in the 1970s to know exactly where this aircraft carrier would likely have been. But that type of information wasn't readily available, but it was to him. So anyway, what I think happened is that one of his contacts told him about what happened and that this craft emerged from the water, circled around this aircraft carrier a couple of times, and then went back into the water again. And that was the sighting. I think it is definitely a true sighting. And even though it was written under a pseudonym, even though none of this can be confirmed, there's no government release documentation on it, I firmly believe it happened. And I think I figured out like who the author of that was. So that was a pretty cool case. But one that was, I mean, there's a lot of cases that are almost disturbing. It was a Soviet case. Trying to think from, I think, 1970, Lake Kronotskoye in Kamchatka. So that's in the Soviet Far East, their Pacific region there. But it was on the peninsula. It was in a large lake, very large lake. So it was inland. This was a scientific expedition working on this lake. I think that is the largest lake on Kamchatka, which is a very large peninsula. And they saw this very large, unusual gray oval object simply emerge from the lake. You know, witnesses there reported that their boat engine ceased functioning as the object appeared. Yeah, no surprise. It rose silently above the water, hovered for a little while, and then just accelerated away. After it departed, the engine, you know, came back online. It was a very isolated area. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was this one, but it might have been a different Soviet case, where in the aftermath of that, some people died very, very oddly within a year or so after the event. I think that might have been that case. But that was a very interesting case. There was another one, one that I've actually discussed a number of times, but I think it's still worth repeating. Took aboard another aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy, in 1971. And we have this one, we've got the name of the primary witness and we have the exact date, July 2nd, 1971. I think the position of that ship was just north of Puerto Rico when you had a little after 8 in the evening. So it was still a little bit light. The ship goes to general quarters or battle stations. And according to the primary witness, he saw this himself. It was an orange glowing sphere that was seen just hovering above the ship, causing people really to freak out. A lot of the sailors were, I mean, screaming. One screamed into an intercom, "It's God, it's the end of the world." This was a very, very significant thing. The communications of the ship, the main witness was a comms specialist. So he said, just before I saw this object and just before the ship went into general quarters, all the communications coming in were just gibberish. So the communications were totally shut down. And they were shut down for about 30 minutes while this was going on. He only got to see the object for about a minute, and then that's when General Quarters battle stations was announced, and he had to go back to his communications station. So he didn't see how this object departed, but he learned that the weapon systems failed to function as well. So clearly they were trying to scramble aircraft. The aircraft would not start. This went on for about 25 to 30 minutes. You just imagine you're on a U.S. aircraft carrier. This is the American Empire's power projection right there. You know, those and nuclear submarines are what it's all about. And this big ship was out of communication for 30 minutes while this object just hovered over it, shutting off the weapon systems as well. I have to think, how would that not go to the president of the United States, who at the time was Richard Nixon? And I have no doubt. I have no doubt in my mind that President Richard Nixon would have been briefed on this. But it's just another drop in the bucket, just throw it in the pile, just another USO case. Now, this one, I don't know if this object emerged from the water or went into the water, but I had to include it. It was just, you're out at sea, this thing is low over the water, and it's directly over a US aircraft carrier. That has to go into the study. So I definitely included that one. But there were others. I could toss out a couple of others that are not military. There's one. Everyone or a lot of people in this field are familiar with the Pascagoula, Mississippi encounter of 1973. It was an abduction case. It was Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. They've both since passed away. They were fishing and they became aware of a strange craft nearby, and humanoid beings took them. But that's not the case I'm talking about. 1 week later, in the exact same region.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week, we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
The United States Coast Guard was called to investigate an underwater USO case that many people had seen. It was this object that was somewhat small, but it was maneuvering in this very bizarre way under the water. Guys are out there with their fishing boats and they hit it with their oar, and it was a metallic sound. The Coast Guard came out and they confirmed this as well. The two Coast Guard personnel were out there to respond to this. They went out there, they encountered the exact same thing. They wrote this up in a report. It was a very bizarre USO that did not behave. I mean, there were such things as what are known as midget submarines, and it would not be impossible that this could be the size of such a craft, but to see how this thing maneuvered, at least by their own account, a submarine cannot maneuver. This thing was rapidly moving and then basically stopping and then maneuvering in ways and turning in ways in the water that a submarine just cannot do at all. According to what they said, this is what happened. So that was a very bizarre case. I'm trying to think of any others that are. There's the Colares, Brazil wave of events in the late 70s.
Yes.
So that's in this book here. And Colares is a place. This is where the Amazon River empties out into the Atlantic Ocean. When I say the place, the Amazon River empties out over a vast coastal area in South America. It's not just one area. It's a massive amount of fresh water emptying out into the Atlantic all the time and carrying with it all kinds of silt and biological material, making that region of the world really biologically unique on many levels and very important ecologically. But anyway, in that region, in the late 1970s, a number of residents of one of the towns there, known as Colares, reported objects in the water, maneuvering in the water, emerging from the water, entering the water, sometimes hovering above in the air, below them, not in the water at all. There's all kinds of UFO and USO activity being reported there. I mean, to the point where locals were really talking about this a lot and encountering this phenomenon a lot, and to the point where this phenomenon behaved in a way that you really could say was quite aggressive. And you could even say violent toward the local people, to the point where people would be hit with beams of light from the aerial objects. Sometimes while they were inside their homes, a light would penetrate through the ceiling or through the walls and harm them. There was at least one reported death from this and many, many injuries. A local doctor treated many of these people. She is a well-known individual. And then the Brazilian military got involved, Brazilian Air Force. In fact, they named it, I think, Operation Saucer, it translated into English. The leader of that was Urangi Holanda, I believe, and he, along with his men, he had his company of 100 men were involved in doing this investigation for an extended period of time. They had their own encounters. And in fact, encounters that actually deeply, deeply affected them. Holanda himself never really recovered and sadly died by suicide many years later. And I think it had something to do perhaps with his involvement in this. I think somehow this disturbed him.
With Calares, even when the beams, it was Operation Plateau, which is Operation Plate or Saucer, which was a translation. Yeah, yeah. I wrote about it in my book. I'll give a quick plug, Richard Atlas, which you obviously
came to
blurb for me. Thanks.
Yeah, I really like your book. Yeah.
It's and even like the beams that were going through the homes, people reported seeing the iron in their blood coming out in the beams.
Yeah.
And there were widespread reports of anemia afterwards with the iron being removed from people's blood, which was really, really odd. But I like those little details in those types of stories too.
It's a fascinating series of events. And it's a bit of I don't want to say it's a complete outlier, but it is a little bit of an outlier among the long history of UFO encounters. You know, you don't really get a lot of extended reports of people essentially feeling like they're being attacked physically by these objects, but you really do get it here in Colares. And it's well supported by testimony. The English-speaking world likes to ignore places like Brazil and think, oh, well, you know, that's not important. It's very important. And those people were every bit as sophisticated as anyone else in the world at the time. And they were quite adamant about what was going on. And there were a lot of outsiders that went in to do investigations. Bob Pratt, Jacques Vallée, and most recently, James Fox, you know, went back down to Colares to do a very, very fine film treatment of it. He really did an excellent treatment of that whole thing.
And, yeah, James does a lot of work in Brazil and Virginia.
Virginia, not really. He peripherally Colares. I'm getting it wrong. He did Virginia, which was much needed.
Yeah, he's there a lot though. But listen, shout out to Alan Levine, who illustrated the book. We've got History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, Volume 2, 1970 to 1989. Richard, you've been great with your time. And just before you head off and I let you do whatever it is you do with your days when you're not on these types of shows, is Amazon the best place for folks to pick up a copy?
Yeah, absolutely. I sell it on, the book is available as an expensive hardcover, a slightly less expensive paperback, a very affordable ebook, and a very affordable audiobook. So the hardcover is a bit pricey, mainly because I wanted those outstanding illustrations by Alan Levine to really look their best. It deserves it. And so it's a little more pricey, but I really think it's a book that will stand the test of time. The paperback is, I think, 39 US dollars. It's because of the color printing as well. Yeah. The ebook is cheap. The audiobook is pretty cheap. And that's Amazon's definitely the best place to get them.
Awesome. Richard, wonderful speaking with you as always. I only touched the surface in terms of questions. So hopefully, again, you've been really good this year, jumping on the podcast a couple of times. It'd be great to have you back on before the year's out to go over whatever it is that's happening in this topic, which is only getting more stranger and frustrating and odd and everything else by the day.
Well, personally, I enjoy coming on here with you, Andy. I enjoy our conversations, and I really like your approach to this phenomenon very much as well. So I think we always have good conversations.
I appreciate that, Richard. Wonderful talking with you. I will speak again soon.
My pleasure. My best to everyone watching your channel.
Hi everyone, if you listen to the podcast on an Apple device, you can support directly by going on to Apple Podcasts and clicking the subscribe button, and for less than the price of a coffee per month, you can get early access to episodes in full, and no adverts or sponsorships like this one you're hearing now. It also supports directly to me at the podcast, so thank you very much. Also, don't forget to go and leave the podcast on Apple a 5-star review, and make sure you click the follow button too. Thanks.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.